So what's it like for you to receive this invitation and perhaps in finding your own way to take it up, to turn towards the fact of one's own mortality, to really invite and to contemplate the fact that each of us, for ourselves, to know that we, like everyone else, but that we are subject to this, to death. Do we feel it starting to kind of shift beyond being an idea? And if so, what's that like? Or do we notice ourselves feeling defended against it, or like, there can be sometimes fear arises, or just a sort of a becoming a little distant? So I'm curious if anyone has something they can name that they notice as a way of that's a response, which might be a response that feels drawn by, moved by, touched by the contemplation, or it might be a response that's kind of more resistant or just sort of holding it, you can recognize it, holding it at bay, or suddenly we've found ourselves really busy thinking about other things, and that may be an accident, and it may be a response, we don't always know. But I'm curious, is anyone noticing anything and just turning towards this that you might like to say? Yes?
I went to the room there. There's a beautiful large table. And the thought that came to me, how fortunate the extremely rich, they can have such large spaces to have dinners with 50 people and so on. But looking at the people outside, being reminded of what you said, although I think about it, all these people are going to be around and wondering who's going to be the first one today that may reach the end. And I realize that the space, you know, the space that is infinite is death. The space that Blaise Pascal was so frightened of, you know, that this wonderful thing that's one for the ages, the infinite spaceness, frightens him. I think death gives that space. Death is infinite.
So for you, some of the responses, both seeing it as relevant to everyone else, you know, that yes, we start to, when we reflect on it for ourselves, we start to look at each other in a different light, actually, that's natural. And it may take us to a sense of something vaster. And that's something that we'll talk about more. But just to notice what that's like for you, because fear, I mean, death, contemplating death may evoke fear, sense of mortality, and it may also evoke a sense of something vast and maybe indestructible. To be aware if there's any tendency to kind of move in that direction, which might be a more comfortable, I'm not saying you're doing that at all, but it's a direction we can kind of go because, well, yeah, I'd like to go in that direction. And that, and whether there's any sense of a me that gets to go there. Because that would be suggesting that one gets to do something one doesn't.
It gave me a feeling of wonder, because my consciousness, I don't know if it's the same for people, when I sort of get interested with little things, like, you know, something to do in the house or somebody is observing an argument, as if my consciousness shrinks. And then when I get a feeling like what I've just described, it kind of expands like a big balloon.
Right.
And it's wonder, you know, it's a sense of wonder to sort of. And there's no answer. It's very much a sort of a don't know road. It's pathless.
Right. Yeah. Can people hear all right? Right. So I don't think I need to reflect much more back of that. But that noticing the way we shrink and what allows us to open, and this contemplation can certainly do that. Thank you.
To me, that came up was how painful this cancer of this earthly creature will be.
Sorry, I can't hear.
So how painful?
How painful.
Yeah.
I can hear the idea of pain. And it's really, it wasn't that much the body, the aftermath of the death that scared me, but it's it is this passing. And the second thing that there is a light in all of us. I can't die.
So again, yeah. Do people hear okay?
Yeah.
No.
So did he say no?
No, I couldn't hear, not sure.
Okay, so you might like to come a little closer, maybe bring the chair around over to here if it's hard for you to hear. But you don't have to. With that, it's interesting to see if one can actually let the fear of what happens, because death, in a way, we don't quite know what that is, but dying, we can see that's something that happens while we're alive, and it's going to involve a whole lot of processes that are probably, certainly potentially, quite difficult. So death and dying are very much, it's a bit like that Woody Allen thing. It's not death that scares me, it's actually going through the process of getting there that seems scary. Because that we can relate to, because we've felt pain and confusion and the things of loss that will be involved in that. So part of contemplating death is actually turning towards that. It's like leaving a sense of space for, what will it be like to encounter the difficult? Sometimes in meditation, the question is asked, what's the point of sitting with uncomfortable sensations? Why don't I just move? And sometimes that's what's right and appropriate and necessary. And sometimes we could reflect on the fact that there will probably come a time in all our lives where we can't adjust our way out of something painful. We have no choice if we wish to be here, to be with it. So part of this, it's kind of like saying, okay, here's an invitation to look at one's relationship with the painful. Because there's a reasonably big chance that in that time when maybe, and hopefully, we really want to be awake and here, we're going to have to include in that some things that are not going to be easy. Whether it be physical and painful, difficult process, or emotional. Difficult, painful processes, and possibly, probably, both. So actually letting that in, letting oneself be touched by that, and that sense of there's something that cannot die, maybe. It's like there's something that's true in this.
No, I know.
And yeah. And very easily we can use that truth, and it is true. There's something true, and there's something not true about this, in the way we hold it, in the same way that we kind of know that we will die and we don't know that we will die. So again, what I would suggest, and I mean the territory that you've both yourself and Gitan have spoken to is part of what's important, but we tend to in a way avoid the territory of death by going to something that we think that won't die, or some, going to heaven is the classic thing, or rebirth if you're a Buddhist, that sort of thing. If we have a belief system and a knowing, it's going to be conceptual to a certain degree. And the danger of using that is that it plasters over the reality. I'm not denying it. I'm not getting into it. I'm not trying to say yes or no. But to not too quickly go there is my suggestion for here.
Good.
And I'm kind of speaking in that too, I'm not suggesting that you are too quickly going there, but just being aware of that, because it's kind of like, I'll get, reborn. Don't need to be afraid. Maybe we'll get reborn, but we don't know how or as what. Or maybe there's something that continues, but we don't quite know what that is. Or if we do, then that's something very powerful in one's life. If we have some understanding of that, experiential knowledge. So not to deny that either.
Okay.
That's true. Yeah. Thank you. So there's a couple more, but I'll just keep.
I just found I could interact that by other things, other people. Like if I wasn't here, but when I die, and I need to do this first, and I need to do that first.
Right. So it's not okay to finish now because there's things undone. I want to get this and that done, and in that way, the contemplation starts to show us what our priorities are. It's like, what's important if we really reflect and live in this light? Something about what's really important starts to show up. that's part of its value and its power. I remember a friend and Dharma teacher, Sharda, who some of you may know, though she hasn't been spending much time in the UK recently. She once was giving a talk at Guy House about this reflection and territory. It was part of it, and she was saying, you know, one of the things to consider is, you know, what would you do if you knew you didn't have long? And one of the staff who was from Australia, who was enjoying being there but feeling the distance from their children, adult children, but feeling the distance, or maybe late teenage anyway, independent children, suddenly realized, oh, actually, I don't want to live here. I want to live there and be closer to those people. And for Guy House, it was quite a problem because that staff member just quit and went home. And it's interesting, isn't it? If we were to live that way, it might cause some complications. But to not listen, if that's what's true, is to risk some real regret. Part of living in the light of death is to actually start to address what we might regret if we don't live that way.
Something I really noticed was, and it's been an ongoing contemplation for me actually, really around this area, has been tiding with that idea of the journey being the suffering, in a sense, you know, and that watching the billboards on the road of aging, you know, as in the body changing, you know, in ways that I'm quite averse to, you know, and even actually as walking over in the park and, you know, sort of noticing more youth or particularly young children, you know, so it's the desire and aversion, you know, happening there, you know, oh, that thing, and with that comes a noticing of probably, I guess the way I frame it is as a waste of time at times. You know, how the reflection on life has been, God, you know, what did I do with that? And then just one other thing I really noticed as I was particularly in the sit here was what came up more was reflecting on people I don't want to lose. You know? So my mum, who's in her 80s now, and is, you know, quite pretty inevitable, you know, that that's going to happen in a relatively sooner time than me, but that's not for sure. So just reflecting on that too, you know, who then I don't want to go, you know, as much as I don't want to go.
Yeah, so one of the contemplations or reflections that the Buddha invited, and I said, you know, the third contemplation is that I too am subject to death. The fourth contemplation is that all that is beloved, dear, and close to me, that I will be parted from. And so part of, we see, oh yeah, there's this process of loss. And there's in a way, a small death that happens when we see some aspect of who we are or something or someone that we're close to disappearing. Yeah. Whether someone we care for dies, and there's something, in a way, of ourself dies, because the relationship is where we know that part of ourself, and then the relationship comes to an end in death. Or something bodily, it's like those little precursors or signposts, as you say, you know, signboards on the way. It's like, oh yeah, this is actually, we're on the highway. And, you know, the signs are, you know, the mileage, distance to, destination is, you know, it's not exactly determined, but we know it's getting less as we head in that direction. And just again, noticing what it's like to let that in. It's kind of one way we can be light with it, and it's healthy to be light with it. And another way, it's not light at all. It's actually something that lands with a sort of a, there's a certain kind of sobriety associated with it. Which doesn't mean it has to be heavy or sort of macabre, miserable, depressed, oh my God, we're all going to die. You know, it's not like that. It's more like, oh yeah. And there's something about that that's very, actually very alive.
Can I just say something that I notice with that is that, in a sense, a greater sense of purpose arrives with that. You know, in this moment. You know, it tends to infuse this moment with much greater sense of meaning and purpose for me.
Yes. And just notice what it is that gives it that. It's true that we actually, when we live in the sort of the unquestioned sort of or unexamined subtle fantasy of continuity, that's part of where we lose contact with a sense of purpose, of urgency, of meaning. Though it sometimes seems that, you know, the way we hear it expressed often culturally is that, you know, thinking about death makes life seem meaningless. Actually, it's quite the opposite. The fact that it comes to an end isn't what takes the meaning away, it's actually what gives it meaning in the end. Yeah. Good. Thank you. The back there, yeah.
So what came up for me is a sense of regret. I guess loss as well. Loss of time, and loss of time that I could have used differently.
I could have. It's an interesting phrase, isn't it, when we look? Yeah. Yeah.
Self-judgment. Not, and I guess I find it difficult to engage with that contemplation because of that judgment, because my default position is that I'm not enough and I need to do a little bit more. And that voice that gets really violent, gets really, takes off the space.
So it's important to attend to that, that there can be a sense of regret, and then on top of the regret is kind of judgment that I should have done it differently. And that, with that, you know, this is also a place for us to practice compassion for ourselves, to understand that we are not actually very well supported by the environment, by the culture, by the media, by the messages. We're not very well supported to live well. Actually, and that's part of what makes it really hard. That's part of what means we become sometimes semi-willing and occasionally enthusiastic participants in forgetting. Yeah, and to see that is actually something really important, not to judge oneself for that. And yet if judgment arises, it's like, oh, actually there's some pain here. Judgment is normally a way of trying to not have to feel the pain by suggesting that the thing that's causing the pain should not have been that way. Now, one way or another, things could not ever have been any different than they were. But what can change is from this moment and in this moment. The past doesn't get to be different than it was. We don't get to have done things differently than we did. But in this moment, in seeing that, then there's a possibility of asking, okay, what can I do differently? If there are regrets, where can I attend to those concerns or needs? What do I need to engage in or disengage from in this light? And start from where you are, because that's where that's the only place any of us can ever start. So part of, again, why the territory is a hard place to turn towards is sometimes what it touches in us is regret, is grief, is judgment. Not just about what's happened, but about how we've lived our lives. And yet, part of what we see here is that these lives are often coming out of a kind of a blindness. This is what the Buddha spoke of again, in a kind of a blindness, a not seeing of how things really are. And there's a collusion in that kind of way of seeing that goes on. So in that, we don't judge someone who can't see for their actions born of blindness. It's more obvious that, oh, how could they do it differently if they can't see? But if we can help someone to see, or help them to navigate, and that includes oneself, to help ourselves to navigate here, then that's actually what's useful there. So again, I just invite you, if you can, to bring some compassion. You are not, by a long, long way, the only person who's ever come to that place of recognition. And actually allowing yourself to feel the sorrow, the regret, without having to push it away, without even imagining that somehow it's wrong that it should be so. Because this might actually be the place from which it begins to turn. And in that, everything that got you to the place of sorrow or regret has its meaning and purpose in the place where you see that and actually say, okay, from here, something else I want to bring or to let go. I'd like to just offer some more reflections, but let's just sit for a moment, just a couple of moments, letting what you've been hearing or if you've been speaking, letting it settle a moment. Noticing one thing that can happen, and it's not that that's what I'm hearing from anyone, but I'm just aware that we can start to think about the topic, which is useful to a certain degree, but it's really important to let ourselves come back into the felt experience of what happens when we kind of engage our whole being, which includes our body, which includes our heart, which includes our mind, because it is a reflection and a contemplation. But just, okay, how am I impacted? Including if not at all is what you notice, noticing that. Being interested in that equally if you're impacted in some other way. Maybe hearing things that you resonate with, or maybe not resonating with what you hear. It's okay. And seeing if you can stay in touch with what's there for you, what you notice or resonate with, as I'm again offering some further reflections. And if you feel you need to make some adjustment in how you're sitting, or if you need to stretch or move a little, that's okay. As a number of you referred to and mentioned, the fact of our death, the reflecting on our death, the turning towards this mortality that is right at the centre of our existence, in fact, it asks us to look at our life, to not take it for granted, and to... It's not something that's gloomy in itself. It's very interesting how it looks from the outside like it's a gloomy topic, or we kind of associate that with it often. And if someone, you know, in a social context, if someone starts talking about death, often it's, oh, don't be, you know, don't talk about that. It's kind of miserable or dark or gloomy or macabre. Or, you know, if you sound like you're interested in it, that's a bit weird. And that, and yet, actually, it gives us something really powerful, something really beautiful, it seems to me, when we don't take life for granted. This is one of the key lessons of reflecting on our death. We don't take this existence for granted. We see something about it. And one of the essential things we start to see or feel more is its preciousness. Its preciousness. The preciousness of life is only in relationship to the fact that it isn't forever. Only because it comes to an end can we really sense and see the value, the remarkable opportunity that isn't forever here. And that preciousness is not actually dependent on how long it lasts for. You know, we tend to think in terms of quantity, how much we get, how long we could have. That's the way our mind tends to work, but actually it's not to do with how long or how much. And there's a little wooden memorial at a monastery in West Sussex at Chithurst, Chittavaveka, the Buddhist monastery there. Where I've had the real good fortune, it feels to me, to spend time on occasion, and it speaks to me of this. And what it reads on the little wooden plaque is just a few words. And I've got them probably word perfect, but it's a haiku, and it reads, "The cherry blossoms cover the hillside for but a few days. Any longer, and we would not treasure them so." And underneath It says little Sammy, and it has a single date. The cherry blossoms cover the hillsides for but a few days. Any longer, and we would not treasure them so. And I remember when I first saw and read those words and just was struck by, and every time I go back, and I was there just a couple of weeks ago, and just again just going and taking a moment there and just reading and just thinking about the preciousness for whoever wrote and put, or whoever put that memorial plaque there, the preciousness of a life that was just one day, a being that came into this world and left it in an amount of time as to be so short. And yet, not less precious for that, but more so. That one sees that and cannot help but see it in such a situation. And of course, the sorrow in that, that one might feel or recognize from what is expressed. And yet somehow, equally, something beautiful, something precious. And what it is to let the preciousness of this life in. That we understand this is an opportunity rather than some kind of thing that we have expectations about or demands upon. This is an opportunity, this existence, this being alive. And one thing that we have the opportunity within this is the opportunity to look at it, to hear and to practice the Dharma, to kind of reflect on the truth of impermanence, of death, to see how that informs one's life. And there's a quality, some vaga, spiritual urgency that arises out of this contemplation of seeing, oh, we don't have forever. We don't have forever. You know, I once saw a great cartoon and it had these series sort of young person, you know, too excited to meditate, middle-aged person, too busy to meditate, you know, elderly person, you know, too unwell to meditate, and then dead person, too late to meditate. And you kind of, you know, in our own way, we can look back and think, oh, all the reasons I found to not do what was most important. And I don't mean just meditation. All the reasons we find to do things that are not the most important. So death really gives us perspective on what matters and what's most important. Again, as some of you mentioned, and I'd like to read a piece from Carlos Castaneda's book about the teachings of Don Juan, who's a shaman and a remarkable teacher. And he spoke this to Carlos, recorded. He said, "Death is your eternal companion. It is always the hunter, and it is always to your left at an arm's length. It has always been watching you, and it always will, until the day it taps you. How can you feel so important when you know that your death is stalking you? The thing to do when you are impatient is turn to your left and ask advice from your death. An immense amount of pettiness is dropped if your death makes a gesture to you, or if you catch a glimpse of it, or if you just have the feeling that your companion is there watching you. The act of your death is never pressed far enough. It is the only wise advisor that you have. And whenever you feel that everything is going wrong, that you are about to be annihilated, turn to your death and ask, is that so? Your death will tell you that you're wrong, that nothing really matters outside its touch. Your death will tell you, I haven't touched you yet. To ask death's advice is to drop the cursed pettiness that belongs to men and women who live their lives as if death will never touch them." I find these words remarkable and powerful, and I've regularly read them, reflected on them, shared them in circumstances like this. That sense of one's life and one's death journeying together. It's not like there's this and then that comes along. it's an accompaniment to the vulnerability of our moment-to-moment existence. And it only reveals itself suddenly. But it didn't just appear from nowhere. Something interesting about that. I mean, this is a shamanic sort of articulation of a certain wisdom and teaching. In a Dharma sense, it's more like having the awareness of this potentiality, having that there. And that, you know, so many times when we're terrified, when we're afraid, when we're feeling compelled, when we believe, I must have this or I can't bear that, if we just stop and reflect in the light of, oh, actually, this is not the ending of my life if I don't get that. The feeling is as if it would be. If I don't get that thing I want, or if that really terrible outcome happens, it would be as if I would die. But it's not. Not by a long way. It's something about just dropping that sense of demand for life to be in a certain way, for outcomes to be according to our preferences. That when we reflect, when we see in that way, we get some understanding. And Ajahn Chah, the great teacher of meditation and Dharma in Thailand in the 20th century, he said, you know, one could own a cup as if it was, and use it and enjoy it, but to relate to it as if it's already broken. It's an interesting concept. The cup is whole, it's useful, you can drink out of it, keeps things hot or cool, hopefully, but it's already broken. It's like understanding that at some point this will break. And that means, of course, one's careful with it, so it doesn't break prematurely. It's not like it's going to break, so what the heck? But that when it breaks, one doesn't go, oh my gosh, how'd that happen? Or why did that happen? It's like, oh, yeah, that's what happens. And this, you know, Don Juan's words, this accursed pettiness that we live with, you know? So much pressure we generate on ourselves, on others, on the world, on circumstances, wanting it to fit in with comfort, preference, ideals, expectations, despite the fact that it so often doesn't. And we see in Dharma practice that there's a kind of a freedom and a space and a liberation that comes when we can be okay with the way things are and relinquish our demand for them to fit in with our preferences, our hopes, our fears or our expectations. And this contemplating of death can bring us sometimes more fully or powerfully to that letting go of, okay, this is how it is. This is how it is. Whether it be to do with, you know, physical comfort or things that annoy us, the fact that it's raining now. I found it interesting. I noticed it was different walking outside. I don't know if anyone else noticed it. Walking outside and having followed my own instruction, which, you know, sometimes I even do that, taking my shoes off, walking, and it started raining. And it was very interesting because although there was that, I could feel that tightening of, oh, I'm going to get wet, it's going to be cold, it's going to be horrible. All of that started to come and it's like really immediately clear, this is not going to kill me. Just because the mind was already there in the territory of thinking about, oh, one day I'm going to die. It's like, it's really not likely to happen from this rain. It's not even cold, actually. And then starting to walk back and noticing, I wanted to walk barefoot. I was just enjoying that. That's me. Someone else might prefer to put their shoes on. That's fine. But just thinking, oh, well, people look and think, it's a bit weird. You know, walk around London with bare feet, you know. And I thought, does it really matter? Again, that urge that I should put my shoes on and look like a normal human being in London. It's like, it really doesn't matter, does it? That other people think that there's someone a bit weird. Whether they might not think that, but whatever. It really does not matter if you or I want to walk bare feet in London in the rain and someone else has their own stuff going on about it. So it's like there's a certain way in which we're more free around things like that, I think. And not just that, but we actually look at each other differently. We look at each other differently. And a number of you mentioned how when we reflect on our own death, we also start to see each other through that light. There was a remarkable experiment that took place in Texas around the conditions and responses of people on death row. And Texas is a a place in which they execute a tragically high number of people, and that's what they do. And one of the things that's known and associated with people on death row, who are mostly quite tough characters who've probably had a really tough, difficult life, and certainly most of them have done some quite horrendous things, and some of them maybe actually shouldn't actually be there and maybe haven't done such things, but just in that environment there's a lot of aggression, a lot of violence, a lot of kind of fear, and they're mostly kept in solitary, away from each other, because of all of that, and because it's perceived perhaps also as what's appropriate for someone on death row. And so this experiment was done, and they actually got the people on death row, and I think they were all men in this situation, into a circumstance where they were kind of doing some projects together. Now, I'm not sure actually what they were. I think it was simple practical tasks, but they were doing it in a different way, in a way that they were actually supported and enabled, and a little bit sort of initially with the presence of others, to actually start to work with each other and meet each other through some practical shared tasks. And what was interesting, that over the course of the experiment, the people running it noticed a really significant change in everybody. And what actually happened was an incredible amount of kindness, of warmth and tenderness started to be expressed and revealed amongst them in a way that was completely unheard of, even in less high security prisons. And so they started asking after some time, and it was some weeks, so what is it that's happening? What, we're noticing something. Can you tell me what's going on? And the response that came quite reliably from the participants was, how was it that there was so much softness or kindness? It's like the response was, actually, here, we all know that each of us is going to die. We know that the person I'm working with is going to die. And something about that knowledge is incredibly powerful for us. You know, the Buddha once said, knowing that you will die, how then can you quarrel with each other? How then can you argue? And you know, there's passages from the texts where the Buddha's followers were described as, you know, quarrelling and stabbing each other with verbal daggers. And you get the sense it got kind of nasty sometimes, you know. As it can be, people relating to each other. We can get angry, aggressive. We can feel hurt, threatened. And that sense of, how can we quarrel? Bringing in, reflecting on our own mortality and the mortality of others. There's a natural kindness and softness, I think, that starts to come, which is part of why we don't do it so easily, because there's a vulnerability in that that we're not sure, I think, we want to really inhabit. And yet, if we do bring that in, there's something really beautiful. There's a way in which we can find an openness in our hearts to other people, even though people might do terrible things, and sometimes, sadly, they do. Even though we ourselves may have done things we really regret, and again, sadly, we do. But seeing our mortality, their mortality, we can also find a tenderness, a kindliness, a care. As we might wish to meet someone and respond to someone if we met them on their deathbed. As we might wish to see or to respond to ourselves if we met ourselves on our deathbed. What might we wish to say to that person? It might be another to that person. It might be ourselves. We might wish to speak of forgiveness or offer it, or to be offered it if it's ourselves. So there's something about that possibility of kindness, that possibility of forgiveness, that, again, contemplating death, reflecting on those who are near and dear to us, what we might want to say or offer to them. And something equally of sharing, of generosity. We talk about generosity a lot in the Dharma teachings. There's this incredibly beautiful and powerful thing of sharing. And you know, of course, when we reflect on death, we see that whatever we keep for ourselves, we don't get to keep it. We just get to have it for a little while, and then we have to let it go. We have to let it go. And how lovely it is to be able to share it with others rather than have it taken from us involuntarily and not actually get to enjoy sharing it. There's a line from the Prophet by Khalil Gibran where he says, all that you have will one day be taken. So give now, so that the season of generosity will be yours rather than your inheritance. Take the opportunity to practice generosity before we die. Because acts of generosity, just as acts of kindness and forgiveness, these are things that stay with our heart. These are things that actually are what's important for our well-being. And these are things that actually are there for us at the end of our lives. And that in terms of Dharma teachings are where our life is likely to rest or can rest in as it comes to its end. Those things that we've cultivated that are wholesome, they are a support in that time. Just as those things that we may have given emphasis to that we recognize as unskillful, they too we will have to face at those times. And that standard image of my life passing before me, that's related in so many ways in so many traditions. It's like there's a kind of a, those things that are weighty of our life are there for us in our last moments. And time opens up for all of that. Time isn't as fixed as we think in that. So we see in contemplating death that, in fact, experience in itself, possessions and things, are not the basis of reliable satisfaction, happiness and peace. That there's an invitation equally to look, what can I take refuge in? If this body will die, if all the things I have, I will leave. If all the beings I'm close to, I'll be part of. And this call, this invitation to take refuge in the three jewels, to take refuge in the Buddha, in the possibility of the human heart's awakening, in the Dharma, the teachings of peace, of freedom, of liberation, that these are something that can actually provide a foundation for one's life that's meaningful. And the Sangha, the community, the sense of connection and shared human life that shares in this reality of mortality, that shares equally in this aspiration for peace, for freedom, for understanding, for truth, and for finding what's really meaningful in life. So again, the end of complacency, the end of a casual engagement with this life, an end to a habitual engagement with this life. This is really what the territory offers us. And the Buddha himself, in encountering the heavenly messengers, and so they're described about encountering an elderly, aged, decrepit person, someone who is sick, someone who is dead. He asked himself, in encountering these, and equally then encountering a spiritual seeker who was devoting themselves to living in sense of exploring and discovering what was possible for a human being, he said, why should I, myself being subject to birth, aging, sickness and death, why should I pursue those things which are also subject to birth, aging, sickness and death? Would it not make more sense, being subject to birth, aging, sickness and death, that I would seek that which was not subject to birth, aging, sickness and death? So that this kind of turning of what's really important. And for the Buddha, this was how he expressed it. This was the beginning of his journey that was remarkable in its degree of commitment and in the profound discoveries that he came to through. And I had, in some ways, I guess I could say, my own experience in this way. And I'd like to just speak a little bit of this. And I can notice, just in turning my attention to this, that there's a way it has its own impact that really is part of my life and will probably always be so. I had a really good friend through school. We used to call him Radar. He had really large ears and they stuck out at right angles, so like radar dishes. We called him Radar, and he was probably he's certainly my closest friend. At times he was probably my only friend that I really trusted. And his family was a refuge for me when my own family kind of disintegrated in my teenage years. And when he was in his early 20s, he was diagnosed with a condition that involved his intestine beginning to essentially die. And he had to have surgery. He had ulcers. His intestine was ulcerated and he needed to have surgery. And in the surgery, something went wrong, surgical misadventure, or maybe it was what was happening anyway, but through the surgical process, his intestine started to die. So they took a piece out and what they left started to die. So they took another piece out and then another piece. And over the course of 6 months, they slowly, in a series of operations, removed the whole of his digestive system up to his stomach, because it was dying and they couldn't let it die in there, which would have been toxic. So he was left with a pipe coming out under his rib cage. And because he'd had so many injections and so many transfusions, and in fact he couldn't digest food anymore, so he had to be fed directly, he had a pipe going into his heart. And it was feeding him directly because all the blood veins had collapsed after too many needles. And he was addicted to the painkillers and his body was shriveled. And he really, that was his life. They could keep him alive that way, but it seemed like a long time. And he was a simple guy in many ways. I remember the pain of his self-awareness. It's the thing almost that strikes, the pain of his knowing that he was addicted, that his life was this small, and that it could never, his body could never recover from this. And he decided to die. He said, actually, I don't want to live this way. Can you take out the pipes? Can you unplug the medications? Can you just leave me here? And since it seemed to be allowed, I don't quite know how, it wasn't going to kill him as such, it was just no longer keeping him alive in terms of feeding him. Over 2 weeks, he just slowly faded away. First week conscious, the second week not. And it was really, really shocking and painful and distressing for me, this really dear person, to lose him. And there's a way in which he gave me a gift. I mentioned the job I was doing in Auckland. I wasn't happy. I was surrounded by people who didn't seem happy. And though everyone was getting on very well with succeeding, it seemed to me it was a miserable thing to be doing. And at the same time, I was terrified of leaving. I had no home or family or anything that could hold me up or support me in the material world. And this was the only thing I had that gave me any kind of material security. And yet I was clear in my heart I didn't want to do it, but I was scared of giving it up. I couldn't do it. At some point I was struggling with myself that I couldn't, but I saw I couldn't. And Radar died. And the shock of Radar's death and the grief and the loss of it was one thing that was really painful. But what also happened, and in a way, part of his gift is how I happen to be sitting here today, is that it said to me, do it now. He said, you can't wait. Because I'd be thinking, oh, if I just work a few more years then, and I have some money saved up, or, you know, some kind of career established that I could maybe go back to, even though I knew I didn't want to do that. And that sense of do it now, just do it now. Because you don't know that you'll get the chance to do it later. For me it was this, I'm eternally grateful to my friend for the gift that he gave me. His choice of do it now was saying, actually, I want to live just a week relatively free of the medication and having faced down the addiction to the painkillers by saying, no, I don't want that. To actually be free for a week. he chose, rather than to be alive for years, but bound in that condition. And I have no doubt that I don't know, of course. I'm not sure I would have got myself out of that situation without his death. I don't know what would have happened. But it was an incredible gift to be given. And so, you know, there might be changes we want to make in our lives. There might be things we want to say no longer. Or things I want to say, yes, I'm going to do what it takes to bring this in. And really, you know, it's my friend Radar's advice that he gave me with his life and his death. Do it now. Do it now. There may not be another chance. So we'll take lunch in a couple of minutes. I just want to finish with a poem by Mary Oliver. But again, just taking a moment to notice how you are. What lands, what doesn't land, what bounces off, what feels like it goes in. There are heavenly messengers all around us. And it's actually an act of courage and compassion to oneself to let them speak to us. Because I think in our heart of hearts we know what's really important. Mary Oliver writes, "When death comes, like the hungry bear in autumn, when death comes and takes all the bright coins from his purse to buy me, and snaps his purse shut. When death comes like the measle pox, when death comes like an iceberg between the shoulder blades, I want to step through the door full of curiosity, wondering, what is it going to be like, that cottage of darkness? And therefore I look upon everything as a brotherhood and a sisterhood. I look upon time as no more than an idea, and I consider eternity as another possibility. And I think of each life as a flower, as common as a field daisy, and as singular, and each name a comfortable music in the mouth, tending as all music does towards silence. And each body a lion of courage and something precious to the earth. When it's over, I want to say, all my life I was a bride married to amazement. I was a bridegroom taking the world into my arms. When it's over, I don't want to wonder if I've made of my life something particular and real. I don't want to find myself sighing or frightened or full of argument. I don't want to end up simply having visited this world."